Good morning. This is Commissioner Susan Weefald. The commission is holding a special meeting today. It's 10 o'clock a.m., October 30th, 2008. The North Dakota Public Service Commission is meeting today in our commission hearing room on the state capitol on the 12th floor here in Bismarck, North Dakota. There are no matters on the consent agenda, but first I'll go to my fellow commissioners and see if they have any welcoming comments. With me today are Commissioner Kevin Kramer and Commissioner Tony Clark. All right.
Good morning.
And any welcoming comments from my fellow commissioners?
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Welcome.
Okay. All right. And we'll go first to SW1. SW1 is I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing a certificate of site compatibility to Empower LLC for phase two of the Laverne Wind Farm, consisting of up to 33 wind turbines with up to 49.5 megawatts of electric generating capability and associated facilities in Griggs and Steele counties of North Dakota, case number PU0834.
Second.
Now, on this particular facility, I'm going to direct you to different findings of fact. Finding of fact number one, that Empower is a North Dakota limited liability company headquartered in Findlay, North Dakota, and Empower proposes to construct and operate a wind energy facility, the Laverne Wind Farm, to be located in Griggs and Steele County, North Dakota, north of the city of Laverne. And the nameplate capacity of the wind energy facility would be 157 megawatts, comprised of up to 105 wind turbines. And they plan, in finding a fact two, they plan to use General Electric 1.5 megawatt turbines, and these are utility-grade wind turbines with a nominal nameplate rating of 1,500 kilowatts. They would have 80-meter, 262-feet hub height and a 77-meter, 253-feet rotor diameter, which means that these facilities would be close to 400 feet tall. The turbines begin operating at wind speeds of 3.5 meters per second, 7.8 miles per hour, and reach a rated capacity of 1.5 megawatts at wind speed of 14.5 meters per second, or 32.5 miles per hour. The Laverne Wind Farm in number six, finding number six, you'll find, will consist of two separate phases. Phase one will include up to 72 turbines to generate up to 108 megawatts of power in the southern portion of this area, and phase two will include up to 33 turbines to generate up to 49.5 megawatts of power in the northern portion of the proposed project area. And the total cost for construction of the Empower proposed Laverne Wind Farm, that's in finding number eight, for both phase one and two is estimated to be approximately $300 million. The action that the commission is taking today is that we are issuing a certificate of site compatibility for Laverne Wind Farm Phase 2. And you'll find that back in our ordering clauses, and that's in ordering clause number 1 on page 9. However, and you'll find in order in clause number 2, that Empower must submit a final Phase 1 site plan for commission approval prior to the issuance of a certificate of site compatibility for Phase 1. In other words, the commission needs more information from the company before we are going to be able to approve Phase 1. I would say that the approximate cost of the facility for phase one for construction would be approximately one-third of the cost of the total facility, so about $100 million for phase one. You'll also remember, if you go back to the commission's findings of fact, that for, did I say phase one? I meant phase two. One-third of the cost is for phase two. All right, thank you. Number 10, you'll remember that Otter Tail Corporation has filed an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct and own the 33 Phase 2 turbines and associated facilities totaling 49.5 megawatts of nameplate generating capacity. That application is pending before the commission in case number PU08766. But what is before us today is this particular project. Everything seems to be in good order for phase two. It's ironic that we're moving forward first with phase two rather than phase one, but that's just the way it is. Phase two, they had everything in order. The commission has looked at many things in this, as you can see by looking at this order. They, for example, had their Cultural One and Cultural Three resource study that was submitted to the SHPO office, and and SHPO has concurred that there's no significant sites affected for phase two. That study has yet to be done for phase one and has not yet been completed. We did look at many different things in this order, including the issues set out. Let's see here. I wanted to comment on the part about the. We have long orders here. Can anyone spot the area about the animals in the plants, et cetera? Wildlife. Okay, number 29. Number 29 and 30. Empower contacted the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the North Dakota Parks and Recreation Department to review the project area for threatened or endangered species and unique habitats. In response to this contact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service identified one federally listed threatened or endangered species potentially present in Griggs County, whooping crane, and no federally listed threatened or endangered species in Steele County. U.S. Fish and Wildlife indicated that the proposed project area is located outside of the 180-mile-wide whooping crane migration corridor, where 95% of whooping crane sightings in North Dakota have occurred. They have identified a corridor 90 miles on each side of the Missouri River. And so that's the 180-mile-wide whooping crane migration order. And this proposed project area is outside of that 180-mile-wide whooping crane migration order corridor. Excuse me. We are finding in number 31 that Empower's proposed turbine locations for phase two should be approved, but we are waiting for more information, as I indicated before, about the for more specific information from them on turbine locations for phase one that wouldn't be needed by the commission. Everything seems to be in order for phase two, and so the commission is, I propose that this be approved.
One of the things that is perhaps unique about this particular filing is this is the first wind farm that we'll be siting, which is a community-based wind project. There are a number of ways that these types of wind farms can be structured from a business perspective. We've seen a number of investor-owned type models, build-to-own models, build to a purchase power agreement type model, but this is one that came out of the Griggs Steel empowerment zone process, and its Empower is linked to that, and is really the first, which is a community based type wind project. I've been of the opinion that in North Dakota we should let 1,000 business ideas bloom, and we're seeing that there are indeed a number of different ways to approach the construction of wind farms, and I think that at the end of the day is good for North Dakota. But from a commission perspective, regardless of what the ownership structure of any particular project is, our job is the same. The statute doesn't change. The standard and the criteria that we hold out for the companies that are looking to build the wind farms are the same. In this case, the project did a very good job of bringing forward the information. I would say that with each application we get, with each wind farm that we site, we probably get a little bit better at siting them. We think of the questions that we want to have answered, and I would say that the applicants get a little bit better at bringing the cases to us, too, because they're able to see the precedent that's been established and the questions that we ask and the things that we and our staff are interested in. So I commend the project developers for the information that they put before us, and thank our staff for their hard work. These, as we all know, are very time-intensive projects, but they're also time-sensitive projects, in that wind farms, unlike more traditional forms of energy, really do come together very fast, especially relative to, as I said, those traditional forms of energy. And it places a burden on our staff and on the commission to process them and to do all the things that we have to do well. And I think in this case, we have done them well, so I thank the staff as well.
Well, certainly the extension of the production tax credit through 2010 will create another, no doubt, wave of activity in the next couple of construction seasons. Until 2010? I think it was through 2010.
Well, I can't remember.
It was either two or through. You guys probably know. At any rate, we'll see a renewed effort at construction, I think, in the next year or two. And Tony's point about this being the first community-based one, of course, we're starting to see all kinds of different formats, ownership formats coming before us. Certainly our siting authority remains the same, but I do believe what we'll start seeing, we may see some move even in this next legislative session, I think, in terms of some of these credits and some of the incentives and who can take advantage of them and who is better suited to take advantage of them. I've been hearing rumblings in some of the communities that, you know, some of those incentives are better suited for out-of-state ownership than in-state ownership and those kinds of things. So I think we'll be seeing some moves. But one of the things that I've been most encouraged by the different structures, regardless of who owns it, is we're seeing quite an expertise being developed right here in North Dakota. Obviously, we already have demonstrated an ability to manufacture blades, to manufacture the towers, we've seen Wanzek Construction absolutely explode with its capacity to put to build the structures. But we're also seeing a lot of other expertise developed. We're seeing in-state engineering firms, in-state archaeological firms and consultants, environmental consultants, build their expertise, and different companies are showing up as consultants for the companies at the various hearings. And it's really quite encouraging to see that circle of influence being growing larger and larger all the time in that area of expertise. So a true ripple effect, if you will, in energy development in North Dakota.
Let alone the attorneys who've...
Well, yeah, never mind them, yeah.
But I would just like to add on to Commissioner Kramer's remarks. I agree. It takes a very great amount of work and study for a company like Empower, which is a North Dakota limited liability company but community-based, to get all of the information that they need in order to come to this point in the approval process. This is a tremendous undertaking for a community group, and those folks really need to be commended for their efforts and their work in this regard.
Mm-hmm. But you only have to get more votes than your opponent to make the final decision. It's a funny thing, I know, politics.
All in favor?
Aye.
SW2, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing a corridor certificate and a route permit to Empower LLC for its proposed 230 kV electric transmission line in Barnes and Steele counties of North Dakota, case number PU0834.
Second.
This particular transmission line is approximately 13 miles long. It will be located in Steele and Barnes County. You can find those facts in number 2 and in number 3 of our findings of fact. This 230 kV three-phase alternating current electric transmission line will extend from Empower's Laverne Wind Farm Collector Substation to an interconnection with a new Pillsbury to Fargo transmission line and Pillsbury Substation under construction by Minn Kota Power Cooperative. That occurred in case number PU0848. You can remember that case the commission heard and approved earlier this summer. All three of these cases work together very nicely. This particular transmission line, you'll find in finding of fact number 6, that the total cost is approximately $4.55 million. The proposed transmission line will be constructed using wood H-frame structures. Each structure will be approximately 60 feet in height with an average span of approximately 750 feet. There were quite a number of federal agencies that, and state and local entities that were contacted regarding this. They did do a Class 1 record search for SHPO and a Class 3 pedestrian survey for archaeological and cultural resources with for a width of 150 feet along the proposed route. And the State Historic Preservation Officer concurred with a no significant sites affected determination. We're not only approving in this particular order the route permit, but also the corridor permit for this company. The corridor and route proposed by Empower for their transmission facility does not include any geographical areas listed as exclusion areas. The corridor and route proposed by Empower for the transmission facility does not include any geographical areas listed as avoidance area, except there are several inhabited residents within the proposed corridor, none of which are within 500 feet of the proposed route. So none of the homes are located within 500 feet of the proposed transmission line. None of the inhabited residences. There will be a minimal loss of woodlands. Empower's proposed transmission facility route, actually it says is located, and this is in number 21, is located approximately 900 feet from the nearest occupied residence. So at that location, noise from the proposed transmission facility is expected to be below rural background noise levels. So it will not be closer than, will be located approximately 900 feet from the nearest occupied residence. Again, number 26 goes into that no rare or unique resources have been identified along the route. It is not anticipated that proposed transmission facility will impact rare and unique resources. Raptors, waterfowl, and other bird species may be affected by the construction and placement of a proposed 230 kV transmission line. That is true of any transmission line. The proposed route, again, we go through that it's located outside the 180-mile whooping crane migration corridor where 95% of whooping crane sightings in North Dakota have occurred. And to help avoid potential impacts to avian species along the proposed route during construction and operation of the transmission line, Empower will utilize suspension insulation with a clearance of approximately 84 inches in order to eliminate the potential for electrocution of raptors. In addition, they'll utilize ball markers along the line in areas of concentrated wetlands and at stream crossings to reduce the possibility of collisions. So they are making a good faith effort to reduce any waterfowl, any type of bird kill. Everything seems to be in order for this route permit and corridor permit, and I recommend approval.
Commissioner Wiefald points to a really important, I think, fact in this project, and that is the incredible cooperation and collaboration among various utilities. As you noted earlier, you've got Otter Tail Power Company involved, you've got Minn Kota Power Company involved, the transmission line that we previously cited, this transmission line, all to make a 157 157 megawatt wind farm feasible and work and get the power to customers. And were it not for that type of collaboration, these projects would be impossible. If it was strictly up to, you know, building 40 megawatt wind farms close to transmission capacity, which we've seen up until recently, you know, that's fine. But to get it to this point where we're having these larger wind farms, it takes that level of collaboration. And I think all of the companies involved are to be congratulated for their efforts.
Mm-hmm. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Next we'll go to Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. I move the commission conditionally approve the transfer of surface coal mining permit number GRGR 0501 from Geo Resources, Inc. to Leonardite Products, LLC. I also move approval of the collateral bond provided by Leonardite Products, LLC, that is in the form of an irrevocable letter of credit issued by the First National Bank and Trust Company of Williston, and to authorize cancellation of the collateral bond previously submitted by Geo Resources, Inc.
Second.
Second.
The reason this is on this agenda is that I believe the closing date for this is November 1 or tomorrow, one or the other. At any rate, it's very soon, so appreciate the opportunity. I know that the companies appreciated the opportunity to get this on this agenda. At the beginning of this year, Leonardite Products, LLC, submitted the application for transfer of sale of the permit from Geo Resources Mine to Leonardite Products. It contains 160 acres that are located up near Williston, and the current term of the current five-year permit expires November 2nd of 2010. The Geo Resources Mine produces about 10,000 tons of leonardite per year, primarily for use in the oil fields as a viscosity agent in the oil well drilling operations. It is Federal Coal, and the BLM assignment of the lease has been transferred from Geo Resources to Leonardite Products. The collateral bond is backed by this letter of credit I referred to in the motion of $170,015 for the permit area. It was issued by First National Bank and Trust of Williston, and we have also received a letter of confirmation from the Bank of North Dakota for this letter of credit. We believe that the bond amount is sufficient to cover the worst-case reclamation condition scenario in this area. Leonardite Products did publish notices of the transfer in the Williston Herald as required for 4 consecutive weeks. We also sent notices to all the appropriate agencies and landowners, and no objections or requests for a conference were received. We recommend the condition be attached to the permit transfer approval to require Leonardite Products LLC to incorporate the business entity lease document related information into the existing permit. Obviously, all of the legal requirements have to be met, and if those conditions are met, then we recommend the permit be transferred.
Leonardite Products, as Commissioner Kramer noted, is a new company that was formed to own and operate this Geo Resources mine. Leonardite Products, LLC, has not previously operated a coal mine in North Dakota or in any other state. This particular coal mine, there was some question of whether it would continue to operate. So it is, I believe, a good thing that another ownership group has stepped forward that plans to own and operate Geo Resources Mine. There is still Leonardite available at that facility, and now perhaps there will be Leonardite Mine there for quite some time to come. But this is a brand new company that was formed and has not had any mining experience to this date.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That's it for me.
All right. That ends the items on our regular agenda. Are there any questions?
The Leonardite Mine site, it's 160 acres?
It is. And the current permit area is.
And the tonnage is approximately
10,000? 10,000 per year.
Okay. And do you know where Leonardite Products LLC is based?
Well, it's based locally. I don't know if it's based in Williston. Is it mainly Williston ownership, I think? Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Are some of the employees even involved? Jim,
yes.
Do you? Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's kind of interesting to see that, you know, in this current economic situation, of course, this process started long before this crisis hit. But, you know, when all else fails, employees sometimes step up and keep the business going. And that's definitely what's happened here.
What's the amount of the bond?
It's $170,015, if I remember. Let me look real quick just to be sure. $170,015, yeah.
Could you tell me how much information is still needed before phase one can be
yes.
completed?
They need to submit to the commission a final siting plan for the wind turbines. In order for them to make that final siting plan, they are probably going to need to complete that cultural 3 resource study for SHPO.
We've got a couple of things that are
SHPO, please.
That have oh, yeah.
State Historic Preservation Officer.
Thank you.
We've got a couple things that are interrelated. You have to know where the final turbine location is to be able to do a cultural resource survey. But the cultural resource survey sometimes determines where some of those towers get located.
If anything needs to be moved,
they need to be shifted.
This is the same kind of issue that you had with Tatanka.
No.
Similar. No. Okay.
No.
Tatanka was a transmission.
They were a transmission facility, and that was a question of, in our order, we have, you can find it in the order that it says that if there are any sightings for either the transmission towers or the wind towers, and they need to be moved, that those need to be submitted to the commission for any approvals, and that's in number 17 in the transmission line one, and we had similar language in the Tatanka one.
Do you have any idea how long it's going to take to complete the cultural study?
Well, it just depends. I don't know how far along they are with their cultural resource study at the present time.
Do you know and who is they?
That's MPower.
Okay, so MPower is...
They hire a consultant who then files that study with Schiphol. State
I
Historic Preservation Officer.
Done fairly quickly, assuming that there's no remarkable features. Now,
yeah,
you get hung up on something.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you please describe where the substation is, the two substations are that are involved here?
There's one sub. Well, there's two substations. You're correct. One that's connected with the Pillsbury line, and there's the other one that's connected with this project. The one that's connected with this project is in the middle, I would say, of the project area, but it's included in phase two of the total project area, but it's in phase two. And the specifics about exactly where it's located are in the order. And where is that, Jerry, in this order?
In terms of like property description or something?
Yeah, there's a legal description.
I think it's on the last pages. Let's see here. It's in the commission ordering section.
Number six?
In the wind farm application.
Oh, the wind farm. Okay, I'm looking at the power line.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Okay, all right. Do we know where the Pillsbury substation is?
Yes, we do.
And
would you like to see a map?
Yeah, maybe I'll just look at them.
All right, I think that would be good, and I have one up here somewhere that I brought in.
I'm just trying. Could you? There was talk
here
about how this is a community.
Here
project.
It shows you.
I'm sorry, I don't have my.
Okay, but that's fine. But this will give you an idea where the substation is located.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. I wanted to.
Mine.
I'm unclear as to you mentioned the community project, and
mm-hmm.
Okay, what is this? What is the practical significance of that? Whether it's a community project or it's an FPL project or a
where the profits go,
Gargantua Corporation project.
Yeah, well, the practical significance really isn't any different in the wind turbines themselves or anything. You know, it's and certainly the impact on the land, which is why we don't treat it any differently from a siting perspective. The business model that they've used is a little bit different, but there are all kinds of business models out there, and I don't think I would tab one as particularly bad or wrong and another as particularly great or anything else. They're just different. Just like you have some cooperatives, you have some investor-owned, they have strengths and weaknesses. The MPower concept is that it's a locally incorporated limited liability company that has spearheaded this. Now, they will be drawing on other resources, and they've talked about in the hearing when we were just asking them more probably of general interest than anything else about that. You know, they certainly will be partnering with other groups nationwide who can bring in the significant capital to help construct these. I mean, as we talked about in the order, it's a $300 million project, the entire thing. So raising that amount of money locally would be very difficult. Oftentimes, these community-based programs will partner with some other national company, or they'll leverage the resources that they have to work with a company like Ottertail, who then purchases one portion of the project. So there's a number of ways that these can come together, and this is the way that they chose in this particular area.
One of the unique characteristics of the MPower project is that all the landowners within the footprint are shareholders in one form or another. I don't know all the details of it, but I do know that that's the case. And so you have land owners who may not even have a turbine on their land, but are neighbors to those that do, who are also part of the ownership team, if you will.
Could you tell me, I mean, there's They've obtained essentially a sites compatibility certificate. And now, is that just being given to Otter Tail Power?
No, it's not, because we have the other case before us. So this is being given to Empower, and then the commission is still considering the case.
And Empower is giving it to. See, is an Otter Tail Power going
Not yet. Not. I mean, the commission first has to approve a PCNN for Otter Tail. All right? So at the present time, we're awarding this to Empower, and then the commission needs to make a determination in the next case, which is before us, regarding Otter Tail and the PCNN. And when we make a final decision in that case, then if everything is in order, Empower could make an application to transfer that to Otter Tail.
Right. There needs really to all be, about who has the
three,
liability. At any
there would need
point.
To be still another case before the commission for that to happen.
Well, it's isn't it true to say that Empower
there's
is,
plans.
They obtain this, they intend to transfer it to Otter Tail Power, and that's why I was wondering about this talk about the community nature of this project. I mean, they're handing it, they're getting something so they can hand it off to a corporation. So what is the difference in terms
Dale,
of
I do,
Otter Tail come in and done this thing themselves, what would the difference
Well, I think the difference is the ability that it gives them to leverage perhaps that other part of the wind farm, that phase one, mm-hmm. which will be developed later than phase two portion of the wind farm. It's not as if, you know, other companies haven't used this particular business model where you've had, you know, large corporations that build a project and then turn it over to an investor-owned utility. So that, you know, part is a little bit different, but or is similar to how some other projects have happened in North Dakota. I think the difference here is the fact that you had really local people banding together and spearheading this effort and getting it going. And if it does eventually go over
point.
To, yeah, if it eventually does turn over to Otter Tail, it gives them, I would guess, some financial ability to then do even more with other portions of the project that they have.
For example, up in Langdon.
Right.
Remember there, we had a community also spearheaded wind development in their area. But there's a difference between that project and this one in that particular project, Florida Power and Light was involved from the very beginning, and they provided all the information to the commission for the application and for the application process, et cetera. In this case, this local group has gone all the way through to this point. They have produced the, you know, gone through the whole process of applying for both the corridor and the route permit for a transmission line and for a siting application for the wind farm. That's a tremendous amount of work that has been put into this project to this point.
Hiring the specialists, the consultants, putting together the package of information from an engineering and environmental standpoint.
But even more significant than that is the ownership at the end of it. I mean, FPL owns the Langdon Wind Farm other than the portion that they then sold to Otter Tail. But when I spoke earlier about or referenced earlier about incentives and who benefits the most, I think, Dale, your questions get right to that, the issue of are the incentives that are in place for wind development or energy development in North Dakota such that they favor one type of a format versus another type of a format, or especially as it relates to income tax credits, as an example, realizing that there's not a lot of income to be gained early in the process like this with the, you know, the heavy capital costs up front and all of those things. So I think you'll be seeing a pretty thorough review of the various ownership types. I know that there'll be some folks from more involved in these community-based projects that will be trying to tweak the tax code a little bit. And I'm not an expert on the tax code, but I've heard enough at these hearings to know that some people feel like it favors the large corporations.
Or at the very least, it causes the utility business structures to tip in a particular way and who you may be able to do business with in a particular way.
Right.
Because those credits go to certain companies.
Is Empower going to retain ownership of the power line?
No. They would construct. Otter Tail has filed an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct and own the proposed 230 kV transmission line along with phase two of the proposed Laverne Wind Farm. Okay.
I
Anything else? Because we can get more questions later, too.
Go ahead. Well,
yeah.
No, I have a different subject. And,
go ahead.
You know,
go.
Okay. There's going to be a vote before the FCC on the 4th, at least planned.
Yes.
Let's hope not.
That's
yeah.
We'll see
okay,
what happens.
I was going to ask about that. If there's a Stop the FCC coalition that's
right.
been formed. And,
it's a big vote, and it's curious that it's on the same day as another big vote, which has raised some eyebrows. What it is for many years, for at least as many years as I've been on the commission, and Susan probably as many as you've been
right.
on the commission, there's been discussion at the FCC and its states about how telephone companies support each other and pay for each other's networks. It's universal service and intercarrier compensation reform. The FCC has scheduled for vote on November 4th probably the biggest overhaul in those programs that has been enacted since, I don't know when, perhaps the 96 Telecom Act. And it could have dramatic impacts on both what consumers pay and users pay, but also the amount of capital that's available for telephone companies to invest in networks, especially in high-cost areas like rural America and in places like North Dakota. It has telephone companies very concerned. It has consumer advocates very concerned. It has state commissions very concerned about what the potential impacts of this could be and perhaps unintended consequences for a lot of the regulatory regime that surrounds telephones in the country and the financial regime that does. The concern is that only bits of this have trickled out. The FCC operates in a very bizarre manner. From an administrative practices standpoint, they operate under administrative practices that would probably never be used in any state in the country because our courts would rein us in. But the FCC has operated for this like this for a long time. What happens is there have been a number of dockets and bits of information and contested hearings and court remands and things like that have been filtering around on this issue for some time. There's one particular court case, it's called the Core Remand, which has come back to the FCC on a very limited issue of how a particular type of VOIP is to be treated. And they've used that remand to craft a 160-page order, which no one outside of the FCC has seen, but apparently overhauls the entire intercarrier comp and universal service regime. And so the way the FCC attempts to kind of vet this is they don't put out the thing for comment like any other regulatory agency would do. Instead, they hold these what they call ex parte meetings. And I've been in on some, and other state commissioners have, and the industry's been in on a lot more than we have. And they're all closed-door meetings, and then later an ex parte letter is written up about kind of generally what was discussed. But that's how they go about getting their information about an order that no one who is talking to them has seen. And the vote on this has been scheduled for November 4th. There's a group of us, our state commission, sent in a letter asking them to wait, put the thing out for comment so we can all read it, we can talk about the consequences, perhaps intended or unintended, and develop a more full record. And a number of other companies, interested parties, so on and so forth, have done the same thing. It waits to be seen whether the chairman has the three votes he needs to pass the order. In the FCC, the way it works, chairman proposes an order, develops the agenda, and then when it's showtime, we find out if they've got three votes for it or not.
Not unlike Congress.
What are the implications that you fear from this, based upon what you do know about it, for telephone customers?
Sure. We talked
a little bit about the access costs.
Sure. What they propose to do is, as we understand it, we don't know for sure, and a little bit more trickles out every time you talk to somebody new, is that they would propose increasing end-user charge, what are called SLIC fees, subscriber line charges. You probably see on your most folks' telephone bills a $6.50 fee right now. They propose increasing that on a number of different types of companies. And this would offset some access charge reductions. Access charges are those charges that telephone companies pay each other to connect long-distance calls. They also propose unifying that access charge rate, which is a big deal for a state like North Dakota. What unifying it means is right now the intrastate rate and the interstate rate, so the call, when a call is connected interstate, it pays a different rate than intrastate. Local telephone companies, rural companies especially, get a lot of their money through the intrastate rate, which is higher than the interstate rate. That's how there's this implicit subsidy. And the FCC proposes forcing the intrastate rate down. We're not sure legally they can do that because, of course, the Act says that states are supposed to determine that, not the FCC. But they propose somehow equalizing those out at a very low rate. And then the question is, how do companies in rural areas make up that money? Apparently, there are different mechanisms that they may or may not be allowed to recover some of that or all of it. But those are the details we're trying to get that we just don't know.
When you say intrastate, is that a literal term here, or are we talking about also calls that go across the ladder line?
It's in North Dakota, I don't believe there are different rates for intrastate, intralada, intrastate, interlada, but
I don't know.
I can't Good be question. Certain on that. I'd have to ask Pat, I guess. But the focus of the order is not on the LATA issue so much as it is on the intrastate.
I'm just
issue.
Trying to figure out what the definition of interstate is.
Interstate is when it crosses a state line. Okay. If one user or another is in a different jurisdiction.
I mean, I guess my question is a call across the LATA line considered an
intrastate, yes.
No, an intrastate call.
No.
Okay.
No. It's interlatta, but intrastate.
Okay.
So is there a concern that the telephone's subscribers, for lack of a better term, might get hit in the shorts again?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. There's a potential that end users could pay more. There's a potential that there will not be enough money to invest into the kind of broadband networks that we all know that we need to be investing in at this time. So there's, you know, there are jurisdictional concerns. Depending on how the FCC writes this, they could declare a whole lot of services which right now are under state jurisdiction to be solely an interstate service, in which case states could lose the ability in some circumstances to perhaps even set basic service charges, depending on how the order is written. So there are a whole bunch of things that could come out of this, but, you know, in 160 pages and not too much time to analyze it.
Our commission is concerned because this is a huge change, and because states really do not know what is in this, we would like to have more time to be able to see what is actually being determined here and have a chance to comment on it. And that's what our commission is asking for, and many other commissions across the country. Suffice it to say, from my viewpoint, that if this does by some chance pass, it will be tied up in litigation for years, because not only our state is concerned about this, but other states and telephone companies and consumers, et cetera. So,
and when you start talking about this, I thought, well, this is just a telecom lawyer.
Right.
It'll keep a lot of people employed.
There's no, but you know, what it illustrates to me, though, on a higher level, is just the difference between how transparently we do business here as opposed to the way they do it there. There being Washington, D.C.
You know, and the irony is, and this is this is getting down into the weeds, but I mean, the FCC operates in a very closed-door fashion as it is right now, but it's in an odd closed-door fashion because they do have certain laws that do not allow them to, you know, to talk to each other, kind of open meetings-type laws. And so the way that a number of members, bipartisan, on the FCC are trying to solve the problem that they have right now is not to inject more sunshine into the FCC process, which is exactly what it needs. You need to have open hearings like we have, where you have interveners, where you have witnesses on a stand, and you hash out the order at an open meeting. Instead, they're proposing to go exactly the opposite way and to grant them an exemption from the open meetings laws so that they can meet as a majority or amongst themselves behind closed doors like a court would.
When you talked about the ex parte meetings, I'm a little unclear as to what did you talk about in an ex parte meeting if you didn't know what was in the document that they were talking about.
Well, these are very bizarre meetings. They, I mean, because there are trade reports that are out, and you know, people who follow the trade press and rumors hear rumors about what might be in the order, and staff and...
They draft their orders after they vote?
Oh, sometimes. Well, what they'll do is there'll be an internal proposed order that staff are kind of working on behind the scenes because the commissioners can't choose not to talk to each other at an open meeting. And so you get bits and pieces that come out. If you get somebody on the phone, oftentimes they'll, you know, read you a paragraph out of it or something like that. And so the rumor mill gets going even more. But they wouldn't, you know, fax you a copy of the entire order. And so you basically bring up with, you know, with the FCC commissioner, well, I've heard that this might contain this. How would you propose to address this? And then they'll answer it as, you know, best they can, and then you move on. It's odd. It's the only way I can describe it.
So these are like in the, on the level of hypothetical discussions almost.
Well, and they all...
Right. Well, they'll even say, well, the order doesn't say that. The order says that. I mean, it... in fact, I've got one with a commissioner in a couple hours. So.
Okay.
We do everything we can to avoid ex parte discussions because we don't like to write the dang memo and put it in the file.
And there's and then there comes a time where, and I guess it hasn't hit yet. I thought maybe it had, but because I'll be having this talk with him in a few hours, I hadn't thought about it. But there does come a time when then you, unless you're a member of Congress, you can't talk with the FCC anymore. And that's what they call their sunshine. It's when sunshine hits, which is when, you can't lobby them anymore. And but the lobbying that you do now is through talking with them and filing ex parte.
What we need to do is, if John McCain becomes president, he needs to appoint Wayne Stengem to be the U.S. Attorney General, and he'll take care of it.
I mean, can you imagine having...
Hasn't John McCain been overseeing the FCC while all this nonsense is going on?
I mean, can you imagine holding a...
just like everyone.
Well, he is on the...
Can you imagine having rate cases before a state commission like this where you never have a public hearing, you don't have witnesses on the stand, you don't have sworn testimony, everything is a paper record that's filed, and then when you need to get more information or aren't sure about something or a position, you have individual company representatives and other folks holding closed-door meetings individually with the commissioners and then writing ex parte letters about what happened at the meeting.
But okay, so you got plenty of information about this, Mr. Thompson, by asking that question. You can see that Commissioner Clark does not feel strongly about this at all.
No,
he doesn't. And all the commissioners are watching this carefully.
FCC reform itself should be a top agenda, whoever's the next chair.
Anyway. All right, let's, for the good of the order, we'll close this portion of the meeting, and then we will move to signing, and then the commission will come back for admin. And I do.